wanted?
I'd have preferred another career for him. But this, I understand, is one of the smaller irritations of parenthood. Children seldom make sensible choices. As I've ignored Raphael for 25 years, I can hardly expect to have a say now in how he runs his life. Piers said, "We have learned today that the Archdeacon's murderer almost certainly wore an ordnance cloak. We have found a brown cloak in one of the washing machines in St. Anselm's laundry room. Did you put it there?"
"No, I did not, nor do I know who did."
"We also know that someone, probably a man, phoned Mrs. Crampton at 9:28 on the night of the murder, pretending to call from the diocesan office and asking for the number of the Archdeacon's mobile phone. Did you make that call?" Gregory suppressed a faint smile. "This is a surprisingly simplistic interrogation for what I understand is regarded as one of Scotland Yard's more prestigious squads. No, I did not make that call, nor do I know who did. It was a time when the priests and the four ordnance in residence were due in church for compline. Where were you?"
"In my cottage marking essays, and I wasn't the only man not to attend compline. Yarwood, Stannard, Surtees, and Pilbeam resisted the temptation to hear the Archdeacon preach, as did the three women. Are you sure it was a man who made that call?"
Kate said, "The Archdeacon's murder wasn't the only tragedy that put the future of St. Anselm's at risk. The death of Ronald Treves didn't help. He was with you on the Friday evening. He died the next day. What happened that Friday?" Gregory stared at her. The spasm of dislike and contempt in his face was as raw and explicit as if he had spat. Kate flushed. She went on. "He'd been rejected and betrayed. He came to you for comfort and reassurance, and you sent him away. Isn't that what happened?"
"He came to me for a lesson in New Testament Greek, which I gave him. Shorter than usual, admittedly, but that was at his wish. Obviously you know about his stealing the consecrated wafer. I advised him to confess to Father Sebastian. It was the only possible advice, and you would have given the same. He asked me if this would mean expulsion, and I said, given Father Sebastian's peculiar view of reality, I thought it would. He wanted assurance, but I couldn't honestly give it to him. Better to risk expulsion than fall into the hands of a blackmailer. He was the son of a rich man. He could have been paying that woman for years."
"Have you any reason to suppose that Karen Surtees is a blackmailer? How well do you know her?"
"Well enough to know that she is an unscrupulous young woman who likes power. His secret would never have been safe with her."
Kate said, "So he went out and killed himself."
"Unfortunately. That I could neither have foreseen nor prevented."
Piers said, "And then there was a second death. We've evidence that Mrs. Munro had discovered that you are Raphael's father. Did she confront you with this knowledge?" There was another pause. He had placed his hands on the table and now sat regarding them. It was impossible to see his face, but Dalgleish knew that the man had reached a point of decision. Again, he was asking himself how much the police knew and with what certainty. Had Margaret Munro spoken to someone else? Had she perhaps left a note? The pause lasted for less than 6 seconds, but seemed longer. Then he said,
"Yes, she came to see me.
She had made some inquiry, she didn't say what, that confirmed her suspicions. Two things apparently worried her. The first was that I was deceiving Father Sebastian and working here under false pretenses. More important, of course, was that Raphael ought to be told. None of it was her business. But I thought it wise to explain why I hadn't married Raphael's mother when she was pregnant, and why I changed my mind. I said I was waiting to tell my son until I had reason to believe that the news wouldn't be too unwelcome to him. I wanted to choose my own time. She could be assured that I would speak before the end of term. On that undertaking, which incidentally she had absolutely no right to extract, she said she would keep the secret." Dalgleish said, "And that night she died."
"Of a heart attack. If the trauma of the discovery and the effort it took to confront me proved fatal, then I'm sorry. I can't be held responsible for every death that takes place at St. Anselm's.
You'll be accusing me next of pushing Agatha Betterton down the cellar steps, Kate said.
And did you? This time he was clever at concealing his dislike. He said, I thought you were investigating the murder of Archdeacon Crampton, not attempting to cast me as a serial killer. Shouldn't we be concentrating on the one death which was undoubtedly murder? It was then Dalgliesh spoke. He said, we shall be requiring samples of hair from everyone who was in college last Saturday night. I take it you have no objection. Not if the indignity is to be extended to all the other suspects. It's hardly a procedure needing a general anesthetic. There was little point in prolonging the questioning. They went through the routine for ending the interview, and Kate switched off the tape. Gregory said, if you want your hairs, you'd better come for them now. I propose to work and have no intention of being interrupted. He strode off into the darkness. Dalgliesh said, I want those samples taken tonight. Then I'm driving back to London. I'd like to be at the lab when the cloak is examined. We should get a result within a couple of days if they give it priority. You two and Robbins will remain here. I'll arrange with Father Sebastian for you to move into this cottage. I dare say he can provide sleeping bags or mattresses if there are no spare beds. I want a 24-hour watch kept on Gregory. Kate said, and if we get nothing from the cloak? Everything else we've got is circumstantial. Without forensic evidence, we haven't got a case. She had only been stating the obvious, and neither Dalgliesh nor Piers replied. 14. When his sister was alive, Father John seldom appeared at meals except for dinner, when all the community were expected to be present for what Father Sebastian obviously regarded as a unifying celebration of community life. But now, and a little unexpectedly, he arrived for Tuesday afternoon tea. With this latest death, there had been no ceremonial calling together of the whole of the college. The news had been given to priests and ordinands individually by Father Sebastian, with the minimum of fuss. The four ordinands had already visited Father John to express their condolences, and now they tried to show sympathy by replenishing his cup and bringing him sandwiches, scones, and cake in succession from the refectory table. He sat near the door, a tranquil, diminished little man, unflinchingly polite and occasionally smiling. After tea, Emma suggested that she should begin looking through Miss Betterton's wardrobe, and they went up to the flat together. She had wondered how she could bundle up the clothes and had asked Mrs. Pilbeam for a couple of strong plastic bags, one for items which might be welcomed by Oxfam or some other charity shop, and the other for clothes destined to be thrown away. But the two black bags presented to her had looked so intimidatingly unsuitable for anything other than rubbish that she had decided to make a preliminary sorting of the wardrobe and then bag and remove the clothes at a time when Father John wasn't in the flat. She left him sitting in the gloaming by the faint blue flames of his gas fire and went through to Miss Betterton's bedroom. A central pendant light with a dusty old-fashioned shade gave inadequate illumination, but an angle-poise lamp on the table by the single brass bed was fitted with a more powerful bulb, and by directing the beam on the room she was able to see to begin her task. To the right of the bed was an upright chair and a bow-fronted chest of drawers. The only other furniture was an immense mahogany wardrobe, decorated with carved scrolls, which occupied the space between the two small windows. Emma opened the door and breathed in a musty smell overlaid with the scent of tweed, lavender, and mothballs. But the task of sorting and discarding proved less formidable than she had feared. Miss Betterton, in her solitary life, had managed with few clothes, and it was difficult to believe she had purchased anything new in the last 10 years. Emma drew from the wardrobe a heavy musquash coat with bare patches, two tweed suits which, with their over-padded shoulders and fitted jackets, looked as if they had last been worn in the 1940s, a motley collection of cardigans and long tweed skirts, and evening dresses in velvet and satin of excellent quality, but archaic cut,
which it was difficult to believe a modern woman would wear except as fancy dress. The chest of drawers held shirts and underclothes, knickers washed but stained at the crotch, long-sleeved vests, and rolled balls of thick stockings. There was little here that a charity shop would welcome. She felt a sudden revulsion and a defensive pity on Miss Betterton's behalf that Inspector Tarrant and his colleague should have rummaged among these pathetic leavings. What had they expected to find? A letter? A diary? A confession? Medieval congregations, exposed Sunday after Sunday to the terrifying imagery of the doom, prayed to be delivered from sudden death, fearing that they might go to their Creator unshriven. Nowadays, man, in his last moment, was more likely to regret the untidy desk, the unfulfilled intentions, the incriminating letters. There was a surprising find in the bottom drawer. Carefully placed between brown paper was an RAF officer's tunic with wings above the left pocket, two rings on the sleeves, and the ribbon of some gallantry award. With it was a squashed, rather battered cap. Moving the musquash coat, she laid them together on the bed and contemplated them for a moment in baffled silence. She found the jewelry in the top left-hand drawer of the chest of drawers in a small leather box. There wasn't much, and the cameo brooches, heavy gold rings and long pearl necklaces looked as if they were family heirlooms. It was difficult to assess their value, although some of the stones looked good, and she wondered how best she could deal with Father John's request to have the jewelry sold. Perhaps the best plan would be to take all these pieces to Cambridge and get a valuation from one of the city's jewelers. In the meantime, keeping them safe would be a responsibility. There was a false bottom to the box, and lifting it, she found a small envelope yellowed with age. She opened it and tipped out onto her palm a single ring. It was gold and, although the stones were small, they were prettily mounted, a central ruby in a cluster of diamonds. On impulse, she slipped it onto the third finger of her left hand and recognized it for what it was, an engagement ring. If it had been given to Miss Betterton by the airman, he must have been killed. How else would she have come by his uniform? Emma had a vivid image of a single plane, Spitfire or Hurricane, spiraling out of control and trailing its long tongue of fire before plunging into the channel. Or had he been a bomber pilot, shot down over some enemy target, joining in death those whom his bombs had killed? Had he and Agatha Betterton been lovers before he died? Why was it, she wondered, so difficult to believe that the old had been young, with the strength and animal beauty of youth, had loved, been loved, laughed, and been full of youth's unmeditated optimism? She pictured Miss Betterton on the few occasions when she had seen her, striding along the cliff path, woolen cap on head, chin forward, as if combating a more bitterly intractable enemy than the wind. Passing Emma on the stairs with a brief nod of recognition or a sudden dart from her dark, disturbingly inquisitive eyes. Raphael had liked her, had been willing to spend time with her. But had that been genuine affection or the duty of kindness? And if this were indeed an engagement ring, why had she stopped wearing it? But perhaps that wasn't so difficult to understand. It represented something that was over and had to be folded away as she had folded away her lover's tunic. She had had no wish to put on memory every morning with a symbol which had outlasted the giver and would outlast her. To make grief and loss public knowledge with every gesture of her hand. It was an easy platitude to say that the dead lived on in the memory of the living. But what substitute was memory for the loving voice and the strong enclosing arms? And wasn't this the stuff of nearly all the world's poetry? The transitoriness of life and love and beauty, the knowledge that time's winged chariot had knives in its wheels. There was a low knock on the door, and it opened. She swung round and saw Inspector Miskin. For a moment they stood regarding each other, and Emma saw no friendliness in the other's eyes. Then the inspector said, "Father John said I'd find you here." Commander Dalgleish has asked me to put everyone in the picture. He's returned to London, and I shall be staying on for the present with Inspector Tarrant and Sergeant Robbins. Now that security locks have been fitted to the guest sets, it's important that you lock yourself in at night. I'll be in the college after Compline, and will see you to your set." So Commander Dalgleish had gone without saying goodbye. But why should he have said goodbye? There were more important matters on his mind than a casual courtesy. He would have said his formal farewells to Father Sebastian. What else would have been necessary? Inspector Miskin's tone had been perfectly polite, and Emma knew she was being unjust in resenting it. She said, "I don't need to be escorted to my set. And does this mean that you think we're in danger?" There was a pause. Then Inspector Miskin said, "We're not saying that. It's just that there is still a murderer on this headland, and until we make an arrest, it's sensible for everyone to take precautions." "And do you expect to make an arrest?" Again there was a pause. Then Inspector Miskin said, "We hope to. After all, that's what we're here for, isn't it? To make an arrest." "I'm sorry, I can't say any more at present. I'll see you later, then." She went out, closing the door. Standing alone by the bed, looking down at the folded cap and tunic and with the ring still on her finger, Emma felt tears welling in her eyes, but didn't know whether she was weeping for Miss Betterton, for her dead lover, or a little for herself. Then she replaced the ring in its envelope and set about completing her task. 15. The next morning, Dalgleish drove before first light to the Lambeth laboratory. Rain had been falling steadily all night, and although it had now stopped, the changing red, amber, and green of the traffic lights cast their trembling and gaudy images on roads still awash, and the air held a fresh river smell borne on a full tide. London seems to sleep only for the hours between 2 and 4 in the morning, and then it is a fitful slumber. Now, slowly, the capital was waking up, and the workers, in small, preoccupied groups, were emerging to take possession of their city. Material from Suffolk scenes of crime would normally have been sent to the Huntingdon Forensic Science Laboratory, but that laboratory was overloaded. Lambeth was able to offer Premium One priority, which was what Dalgleish requested. He was well known at the lab and was greeted with warmth by the staff. Dr. Anna Prescott, the senior forensic biologist who was awaiting him, had given evidence for the Crown in a number of his cases, and he knew how much success had depended on her reputation as a scientist, on the confidence and lucidity with which she presented her findings to the court, and on her calm assurance under cross-examination. But, like all forensic scientists, she wasn't an agent of the police. If Gregory were ever brought to trial, she would be there as an independent expert witness with allegiance only to the facts. The cloak had been dried in the laboratory drying cupboard, and had now been spread out on one of the wide search tables under the glare of the 4 fluorescent lights. Gregory's tracksuit had been taken to another part of the lab to avoid cross-contamination. Any transferred fibers from the tracksuit would be recovered from the surface of the cloak with adhesive tape, and then be examined by comparison microscopy. If this initial preliminary microscope examination suggested that there was a match, a further series of comparative tests would be undertaken, including the instrumental analysis of the chemical composition of the fiber itself. But all that, which would take considerable time, was in the future. The blood had already gone for analysis, and Dalgleish awaited the report without anxiety. He had no doubt that it had come from Archdeacon Crampton. What Dr. Prescott and he were looking for now were hairs. Together, gowned and masked, they bent over the cloak. Dalgleish reflected that the keen human eye was a remarkably effective instrument of search. It took them only a few seconds to find what they were seeking. Twisted in the brass chain at the neck of the cloak were 2 grey hairs. Dr. Prescott unwound them with delicate care and placed them in a small glass dish. She immediately examined them under a low-power microscope and said with satisfaction, both have roots. That means there's a good chance of getting a DNA profile.
16. 2 days later, at 7:30 in the morning, the message from the laboratory was telephoned to Dalgleish at his Thameside flat. The two hair roots had yielded their DNA, and it was Gregory's. It was news that Dalgleish had expected, but he still received it with a small surge of relief. Comparison microscopy of fibers on the cloak and on the top of the tracksuit had given a match, but the results of the final tests were still awaited. Replacing the receiver, Dalgleish paused for a moment's thought. To wait or to act now? He was unwilling to leave it longer before making an arrest. The DNA showed that Gregory had worn Ronald Treves' cloak, and the fiber match could only confirm this main incontrovertible finding. He could, of course, ring Kate or Piers at St. Anselm's. Both were perfectly competent to make an arrest. But he needed to be there himself, and he knew why. The act of arresting Gregory, of speaking the words of the caution, would in some way assuage the defeat of his last case, when he had known the identity of the murderer, had listened to his quickly withdrawn confession, but hadn't sufficient evidence to justify arrest. Not to be present now would leave something incomplete, although he was unsure precisely what. As expected, the 2 days had been more than usually busy. He had returned to a backlog of work, to problems which were his responsibility and others which laid their weight on his mind, as they did on the minds of all senior officers. The force was seriously understaffed. There was an urgent need to recruit intelligent, educated and highly motivated men and women from all sections of the community at a time when other careers offered this sought-after group higher salaries, greater prestige, and less stress. There was the need to reduce the burden of bureaucracy and paperwork, to increase the effectiveness of the detective force, and to tackle corruption in an age when bribery wasn't a £10 note slipped into a back pocket, but a share in the huge profits of the illegal drugs trade. But now, at least for a short time, he would return to St. Anselm's. It was no longer a place of unsullied goodness and peace, but there was a job to be finished and people he wanted to see. He wondered if Emma Lavenham was still in college. Putting aside thoughts of his crowded diary, the weight of files requiring attention, the meeting planned for the afternoon, he left a message for the assistant commissioner and his secretary. Then he rang Kate. All was quiet at St. Anselm's. Abnormally so, Kate thought. People were going about their daily business with a kind of subdued intensity, as if that bloody corpse still lay under the doom in the church. It seemed to her that the whole house was waiting for a consummation, half longed for and half dreaded. Gregory hadn't shown himself. He had, at Dalgleish's request, handed over his passport after the last interrogation, and there was no fear that he would abscond. But flight had never been an option. It was no part of Gregory's plan to be hauled back ignominiously from some inhospitable foreign refuge. It was a cold day, and he smelled in the London air for the first time the metallic tang of winter. A biting but fitful wind scoured the city, and by the time he reached the A12 it was blowing in strong, more sustained blasts. The traffic was unusually light, except for the trucks on their way to the East Coast ports, and he drove smoothly and fast, his hands lightly on the wheel, his eyes fixed ahead. What had he but two grey hairs as the frail instruments of justice? They would have to be enough. His thoughts moved from the arrest to the trial, and he found himself rehearsing the case for the defence. The DNA could not be challenged. Gregory had worn Ronald Treves' cloak. But the defence counsel would probably claim that Gregory, when giving that last Greek lesson to Treves, had borrowed it, perhaps complaining of feeling cold, and that at the time he had been wearing his black tracksuit. Nothing was less likely, but would a jury believe that? Gregory had a strong motive, but so had others, including Raphael.
The twig found on the floor of Raphael's sitting room could have blown in unseen when he left his set to go to Peter Buckhurst. The prosecution would probably be wise not to make too much of it. The telephone call to Mrs. Crampton, put through from the box in the college, was dangerous to the defense, but it could have been made by 8 other people, and possibly by Raphael. And then there was a case to be made against Miss Betterton. She had motive and opportunity, but had she the strength to wield that heavy candlestick? No one now would know. Agatha Betterton was dead. Gregory had not been accused of her murder, nor of murdering Margaret Munro. In neither case had there been sufficient evidence even to justify his arrest. He made the journey in under 3.5 hours. Now he was at the end of the approach road, and saw before him a waste of turbulent sea, white-specked to the horizon. He stopped the car and rang Kate. Gregory had left his cottage some 30 minutes previously, and was walking on the beach. Dalgleish said, "Wait for me at the end of the coast road, and bring cuffs with you. We may not need them, but I'm taking no chances." Within minutes he saw her walking towards him. Neither spoke as she got into the car, and he reversed and drove back to the steps leading to the beach. They could see Gregory now, a lone figure in an ankle-length tweed coat, the collar turned up against the wind, standing at the side of one of the decaying groins and staring out to sea. As they scrunched over the shingle, a sudden gust tore at their jackets, making it difficult to stand upright. But the howling of the wind was scarcely heard above the thunder of the sea. Wave upon wave crashed in explosions of spray, boiling around the groins and setting balls of spume, dancing and rolling like iridescent soap bubbles on the high ridges of shingle. They walked side by side towards the still figure, and Gregory turned and watched them coming. Then, when they were within 20 yards, he stepped with deliberation on the edge of the groin and walked along its length to a post at the end. It was only about 2 feet square and less than 1 foot above the inrushing tide. Dalgleish said to Kate, "If he goes in, ring St. Anselm's. Tell them we need the boat and an ambulance." Then, with equal deliberation, he stepped up onto the groin and moved towards Gregory. When he was within 8 feet, he stopped, and the two men stood facing each other. Gregory called out strong-voiced, but his words only just reached Dalgleish above the tumult of the sea. "If you've come to arrest me, well, here I am, but you'll need to come closer. Isn't there some ridiculous rigmarole of a caution you need to pronounce? I take it I have a legal right to hear it." Dalgleish did not shout a reply. For 2 minutes they stood in silence regarding each other, and it seemed to him that the brief stretch of time covered 30 lifetimes of transitory self-knowledge. What he felt now was something new, an anger, stronger than any he could remember. The anger he had felt when he had stood looking down at the archdeacon's body was nothing compared with this overwhelming emotion. He neither liked it nor distrusted it, but simply accepted its power. He knew why he had been reluctant to face Gregory across that small table in the interviewing room. By standing a little apart, he had distanced himself from more than the physical presence of his adversary. Now he could distance himself no longer. For Dalgleish, his job had never been a crusade. He knew detectives for whom the sight of the victim in his or her pathetic final nothingness imprinted on the mind an image so powerful that it could only be exorcised at the moment of arrest. Some, he knew, even made their private bargains with fate. They wouldn't drink, go to the pub, or take a holiday until the killer was caught. He had shared their pity and outrage, but never their personal involvement and antagonism. For him, detection had been a professional and intellectual commitment to the discovery of the truth. That wasn't what he felt now. It wasn't only that Gregory had desecrated a place in which he had been happy. He asked himself bitterly what sanctifying grace was bestowed on St. Anselm's by the mere fact of Adam Dalgleish's happiness. It wasn't only that he revered Father Martin and couldn't forget the priest's stricken face as he looked up at him from Crampton's body. Or that other moment, the soft brush of dark hair against his cheek, and Emma trembling in his arms so briefly that it was difficult to believe that the embrace had ever happened. This overpowering emotion had an additional, more primitive, more ignoble cause. Gregory had planned the murder and carried it out when he, Dalglish, was sleeping within 50 yards. And now he planned to complete his victory. He would swim out to sea, content in the element he loved, to a merciful death by cold and exhaustion. And he planned more than that. Dalglish could read Gregory's mind as clearly as he knew Gregory was reading his. He planned to take his adversary with him. If Gregory went into the water, so would he. He had no choice. He could not live with the memory that he had stood and watched while a man swam to his death. And he would be risking his life not out of compassion and humanity, but out of obstinacy and pride. He assessed their relative strengths. In physical condition, they were probably about equal. But Gregory would be the stronger swimmer. Neither would last long in the bitterly cold sea, but if help came quickly, as it would, they could survive. He wondered whether to move back and instruct Kate now to ring St. Anselm's and to get the rescue boat launched, but decided against it. If Gregory heard cars racing along the cliff path, he would hesitate no longer. There was still a chance, however faint, that he would change his mind. But Dalglish knew that Gregory had one almost overwhelming advantage. Only one of them was happy to die. And still they stood. And then, almost casually, as if this were a summer day and the sea a shimmering stretch of blue and silver under the radiance of the sun, Gregory dropped the coat from his shoulders and dived. For Kate, the 2 minutes of confrontation had seemed interminable. She had stood immobile, as if every muscle were locked, her eyes fixed on the two motionless figures. Involuntarily but carefully, she had edged forward. The tide swept over her feet, but she was unaware of its cold bite against her legs. Through stiff jaws, she had found herself muttering and cursing, "Come back! Come back! Let him be!" Urging with an intensity which must surely reach Dalglish's unyielding back. Now it had happened, and she could act. She stabbed out the college number and heard the ringing tone. There was no reply, and she found herself mouthing obscenities she would never normally have uttered. The ringing continued, and then she heard Father Sebastian's measured tones. She tried to keep her voice steady. "It's Kate Miskin from the beach, Father. Dalglish and Gregory are in the water. We need the boat and an ambulance, quickly." Father Sebastian didn't question her. He said, "Stay where you are to mark the place. We'll be with you." And now there was an even longer wait, but one she timed. It was 3 1/4 minutes before she heard the sound of cars. Gazing across the leaping waves, she could no longer glimpse the two heads. She ran to the end of the groin and stood where Gregory had stood, oblivious to the waves slurping over the post and the slash of the wind. And now she had a sudden sight of them, the grey head and the dark, only a couple of yards apart, before the sleek curve of a wave and a burst of spray hid them from sight. It was important to keep them in view if she could, but from time to time she glanced towards the steps. She had heard more than one car, but only the Land Rover was visible parked at the edge of the cliff. It looked as if the whole college had arrived. They were working swiftly and methodically. The doors of the shed had been opened, and a launch pad of slatted wood rolled out over the gritty slope of the beach. The rigid inflatable was pushed down it, then lifted with 3 men each side. They ran with it to the edge of the sea. She saw that Pilbeam and Henry Bloxham were to make the rescue, and felt a little surprised that it was Henry instead of the stronger-looking Stephen Morby. But perhaps Henry was the more experienced sailor. It seemed impossible that they could launch the craft against this crushing weight of water, but within seconds she heard the roar of the outboard engine and they were heading out to sea, then coming towards her in a wide sweep. Again she had a brief glimpse of the heads and pointed towards them. And now neither of the swimmers nor the boat could be seen, except momentarily when it crested a wave. There was nothing more she could do, and she turned to join the group running along the beach. Raphael was carrying coiled rope, Father Peregrine had a life belt, and Piers and Robbins had hoisted two rolled canvas stretchers onto their shoulders. Mrs. Pilbeam and Emma were there, Mrs. Pilbeam with a first aid box and Emma with towels and a pile of bright-colored blankets. They came together in a little group and stared out to sea. And now the boat was returning. The sound of the engine was louder, and it suddenly appeared, rearing high on a wave before plunging into the trough. Raphael said, "They've got them. There are four on board." They were coming in fairly strongly now, but it seemed impossible that the boat could survive in so rough a sea. And then the worst happened. They no longer heard the engine and saw Pilbeam desperately bending over it. And now the boat was powerless, thrown from side to side like a child's toy. Suddenly, within 20 yards of the shore, it reared up, was for a couple of seconds motionless and upright, then capsized. Raphael had tied the end of the rope to one of the uprights of the groin, and now, fixing the other end round his waist, went into the sea. Stephen Morby, Piers, and Robbins followed. Father Peregrine had thrown off his cassock, and now hurled himself under the advancing waves, as if this turbulent sea were his element. Henry and Pilbeam, helped by Robbins, were managing to fight their way ashore. Father Peregrine and Raphael took hold of Dalgleish, Stephen and Piers of Gregory. Within seconds they were thrown onto the bank of shingle, and Father Sebastian and Father Martin hurried forward to help drag them up the beach. They were followed by Pilbeam and Henry, who lay gasping while the waves broke over them. Only Dalgleish was unconscious, and, running to where he lay, Kate saw that he had struck his head against the groin and that blood, mixed with seawater, was running over his torn shirt. There was a mark on his throat, red as the flowing blood, where Gregory's hands had grasped him. She pulled off the shirt and pressed it against the wound, then heard Mrs. Pilbeam's voice. "Leave him to me, miss. I've got bandages here." But it was Morby who took control. He said, "Let's get the water out of him first," and turning Dalgleish over, started resuscitation. A little apart, Gregory, naked except for a pair of shorts, was sitting with his head between his hands, gasping for breath, watched over by Robbins. Kate said to Piers, "Get some blankets round him and a hot drink into him. As soon as he's warm enough and fit to understand what you're doing, charge him and put the cuffs on him. We're not taking chances. Oh, and you may as well add attempted murder to the main charge." She turned again to Dalgleish. Suddenly he retched, spewed water and blood, and muttered something indistinct. It was then that Kate was first aware of Emma Lavenham, kneeling white-faced at his head. She didn't speak, but catching Kate's glance, got up and moved a little apart, as if realizing she had no place there. They could hear no ambulance arriving, and had no idea how long it would take. Now Piers and Morby lifted Dalgleish onto one of the stretchers and began trudging with it to the waiting cars, Father Martin at Dalgleish's side. The group who'd been in the water stood shivering, blanket-wrapped, passing a flask from hand to hand, then began making their way towards the steps. Suddenly the clouds parted, and a frail ray of sunlight illuminated the beach. Watching the young male bodies toweling their wet hair and jogging to restore circulation, Kate could almost believe that this was a summer bathing party, and that at any moment they would begin chasing each other across the sand. They had reached the top of the cliff, and the stretcher was being loaded into the back of the Land Rover. Kate was aware that Emma Lavenham was at her side. Emma said, "Will he be all right?" "Oh, he'll live. He's tough. Head wounds bleed a lot, but it didn't look deep. He'll be discharged and back in London within days. We all shall." Emma said, "I'm going back to Cambridge tonight. Will you say goodbye to him for me and give him my best wishes?" Without waiting for a reply, she turned away and joined the little group of ordnance. Gregory, handcuffed and shrouded in blankets, was being pushed into the Alfa Romeo by Robbins. Piers moved over to Kate, and both of them looked over to Emma. Kate said, "She's going back to Cambridge this evening." "Well, why not? That's where she belongs." Piers said, "And where do you belong?" He didn't really need an answer, but she said, "With you, and Robbins, and A.D. Where did you suppose? This is my job, after all." Book 4. An End and a Beginning. Dalgliesh came to St. Anselm's for the last time on a perfect day in mid-April, in which sky, sea, and the quickening earth conspired in a soft compliance of settled beauty. He drove with the car roof down, and the rush of air against his face brought with it the essence, sweet-smelling, nostalgic, of the Aprils of boyhood and youth. He had set out with some misgivings, but they had been thrown off with the last eastern suburb, and now his inner weather matched the calm of the day. The letter had come from Father Martin, a warm invitation to visit now that St. Anselm's had been officially closed. He had written, "It will be good to have the opportunity to say goodbye to our friends before we leave, and we are hoping that Emma will also be with us for the April weekend." He had wanted Dalgliesh to know that she would be there. Had he also warned her, and if so, would she decide not to come? And here at last was the familiar turning, easy to miss without the ivy-clad ash. The front gardens of the twin cottages were massed with daffodils, their brilliance in contrast to the soft yellow of the primroses clumped in the grass verge. The hedges on each side of the lane were showing their first green shoots, and when, with a lifting of the heart, he first saw the sea, it stretched in untroubled bands of shimmering blue to a purple horizon. High overhead, unseen and hardly audible, a fighter aircraft shed its tattered ribbon of white across a cloudless sky. Under its radiance, the mere was a milky blue, unthreatening and peaceful. He could imagine the gleam of shining fish sliding beneath that untroubled surface. The storm on the night of the Archdeacon's murder had broken up the last timbers of the sunken ship, and now not even that black fin of wood remained, and the sands stretched, untrodden between the bank of shingle and the sea. On such a morning, Dalgliesh couldn't even regret this evidence of time's obliterating power. Before turning north along the coastal road, he drew to the edge of the cliff and switched off the ignition. There was a letter he needed to read again. He had received it a week before Gregory had been sentenced to life imprisonment for the murder of Archdeacon Crampton. The writing was firm, precise, and upright. There was no superscription. Only on the envelope had Dalgliesh's name appeared. "I apologize for this writing paper, which you will understand is not my choice. You will have been told by now that I've decided to change my plea to guilty. I could claim that my reason is to spare those pathetic fools, Father Martin and Father John, the ordeal of appearing as witnesses for the prosecution, or my reluctance to see my son or Emma Lavenham exposed to the somewhat brutal ingenuity of my defense lawyer. You will know me better. My reason is, of course, to ensure that Raphael doesn't all his life suffer the stigma of suspicion. I have come to realize that there is a very real chance that I might be acquitted. My lawyer's brilliance is almost proportionate to the size of his fee, and he early made it plain that he was confident that I could get away with it, although he was careful not to use those particular words. I am, after all, so very middle class, so very respectable. I had always planned to be acquitted if the case ever came to court, and had no doubt that I would be. But then, I had planned to murder Crampton on a night when I knew Raphael would not be in college. As you know, I took the precaution of calling in at his set to check that he had, in fact, left.
Had I found him in his room, would I have gone ahead with the murder? The answer is no. Not that night, and perhaps never. It is unlikely that all the conditions necessary for success would have so fortuitously come together again. I find it interesting that Crampton died because of Raphael's simple act of kindness to a sick friend. I have noticed before how often evil comes out of good. As a parson's son, you are more competent than am I to address this theological conundrum. People who, like us, live in a dying civilization have three choices. We can attempt to avert the decline as a child builds a sandcastle on the edge of the advancing tide. We can ignore the death of beauty, of scholarship, of art, of intellectual integrity, finding solace in our own consolations. And that is what, for some years, I've tried to do. Thirdly, we can join the barbarians and take our share of the spoils. That is the popular choice, and in the end it was mine. My son's God was chosen for him. He has been in the power of those priests since he was born. I wanted to give him a choice of a more contemporary deity. Money. Now he has money and will find that he's unable to face giving it away. Not all of it. He will remain a rich man. Time will show whether he remains a priest. I imagine that there's nothing I can tell you about the murder which you don't know. My anonymous note to Sir Alred was, of course, designed to stir up trouble for St. Anselm's and Sebastian Morell. I could hardly have expected that it would bring to the college the most distinguished of Scotland Yard's detectives, but your presence, so far from deterring me, added challenge to expediency. My plan to entice the Archdeacon to the church worked perfectly. He could hardly wait to view the abomination which I had described to him. The tin of black paint and the brush were conveniently ready for me in the sanctuary, and I confess, I enjoyed my vandalizing of the doom. It's a pity Crampton had so little time to contemplate my artistry. You may be wondering about those two deaths for which I was not charged. The first, the suffocation of Margaret Munro, was a necessity. It required little planning, and her death was easy, almost natural. She was an unhappy woman who probably had little time left, but in that time she could have done damage. It didn't matter to her whether her life was shorter by a day, a month, or a year. It did matter to me. I'd planned for Raphael's parentage to be known only after St. Anselm's had been closed and the furor of the murder had died down. Of course, you early realized the nub of my plan. I wanted to kill Crampton and at the same time throw suspicion on the college without providing conclusive evidence against myself. I wanted the college closed early, preferably before my son was ordained, and I wanted his inheritance to be intact. And, I must confess, I also took pleasure at the prospect of Sebastian Morell's career ending in suspicion, failure, and ignominy. He had ensured that mine should end in just that way. You will wonder, perhaps, about the unfortunate death of Agatha Betterton, another unhappy woman. But that was merely taking advantage of an unexpected opportunity. You were wrong if you thought that she was at the top of the stairs when I made that telephone call to Mrs. Crampton. She didn't see me then. She did, however, see me on the night of the murder, when I was returning the key. I could, I suppose, have killed her then, but I decided to wait. She was, after all, regarded as mad. Even if she accused me of being in the house after midnight, I doubt whether her word would have stood up against mine. As it was, she came Sunday evening to tell me that my secret was perfectly safe. She was never a coherent woman, but she gave me to understand that no one who had killed Archdeacon Crampton had anything to fear from her. It wasn't a risk I could take. You do realize that you wouldn't be able to prove either of those deaths. Motive isn't enough. If this confession is used against me, I shall repudiate it. I have learned something surprising about murder, about violence generally. It's probably known to you, Dalgleish. You are, after all, an expert in these matters. Personally, I find it interesting. The first blow was deliberate. not without a natural squeamishness and some repugnance, but a matter of summoning the will. My mental process was unambiguous. I need this man dead. This is the most effective way to kill him. I had intended a single blow, two at most. But it's after the first strike that the adrenaline surges. The lust for violence takes over. I went on striking without conscious will. Even if you had appeared at that moment, I doubt whether I could have stopped. It is not when we contemplate violence that the primitive instinct to kill takes over. It is only when we strike the first blow. I have not seen my son since my arrest. He has no wish to meet me, and no doubt it's just as well. I have lived all my life without human affection, and it would be awkward to indulge in it now. And there the letter ended. Folding it away, Dalgliesh wondered how Gregory would endure imprisonment, which might well last for 10 years. Provided he had his books, he would probably survive. But was he, even now, looking out from his barred window and wishing that he, too, could smell the sweetness of this spring day? He started the car and drove straight to the college. The front door stood wide open to the sunlight, and he stepped into the emptiness of the hall. The lamp still burned at the foot of the statue of the Virgin, and there still lingered on the air the faint ecclesiastical smell, compounded of incense, furniture polish, and old books. But it seemed to him that the house had already been partly stripped, and that it now waited with a quiet resignation for the inevitable end. There was no sound of footfalls, but suddenly he was aware of a presence, and looking up saw Father Sebastian standing at the head of the stairs. He called, "Good morning, Adam. Please come up." It was the first time, thought Dalgliesh, that the warden had used his Christian name. Following him into his office, Dalgliesh saw that there had been changes. The Burne-Jones picture no longer hung above the fireplace, and the sideboard had also gone. There was a subtle change, too, in Father Sebastian. The cassock had been put aside, and he now wore a suit with a clerical collar. And he looked older. The murder had taken its toll, but the austere and handsome features had lost none of their authority or confidence, and something had been added. The controlled euphoria of success. The university chair he had gained was prestigious, and it was one he must have coveted. Dalgliesh congratulated him. Morel said, "Thank you. It is said to be a mistake to go back, but I hope that for me and for the university it will prove otherwise." They sat and talked for a few minutes, a necessary concession to politeness. It was not in Morel's nature to feel ill at ease, but Dalgliesh sensed that he was still irked by the distasteful thought that the man now sitting opposite him had once regarded him as a possible murder suspect, and he doubted whether Morel would ever forget or forgive the indignity of his fingerprinting. Now, as if feeling under an obligation, he brought Dalgliesh up to date with the changes in the college. "The students have all been found places at other theological colleges. The four ordinands you met when the archdeacon was murdered have been accepted at Cuddesdon or St. Stephen's House, Oxford." Dalgliesh said, "So Raphael is going ahead with his ordination?" "Of course. Did you think he wouldn't?" He paused, then added, "Raphael has been generous, but he will still be a rich man." He went on to speak briefly about the priests, but with more openness than Dalgliesh had expected. Father Peregrine had accepted a post as archivist in a library in Rome, a city to which he had always been anxious to return. Father John had been offered the job of chaplain to a convent near Scarborough. Since, as a convicted paedophile, he was required to register any change of address, it was felt that the convent would offer as safe a refuge as had St. Anselm's. Dalgliesh, suppressing a smile, privately agreed that no more suitable post could have been found. Father Martin was buying a house in Norwich, and the Pilbeams would move in to look after him, inheriting the house when he died. Although Raphael's right to his inheritance had been confirmed, the legal position was complicated, and there was much to be decided. including whether the church would be taken into the local group ministry or deconsecrated. Raphael was anxious that the Van der Weyden should be used as an altarpiece, and an appropriate place was being sought. The picture was at present safely locked in a bank security vault, as was the silver. Raphael had also decided to give the Pilbeams their cottage, and Eric Surtees his. The main building had been sold as a residential center for meditation and alternative medicine. Father Sebastian's tone conveyed a nicely judged distaste, but Dalgliesh guessed that he thought it could have been worse. In the meantime, the four priests and the staff were temporarily staying on at the request of the trustees until the building was handed over. When it was apparent that the interview was over, Dalgliesh handed Father Sebastian Gregory's letter. He said, "I think you have a right to see this." Father Sebastian read in silence. At the end, folding it and returning it to Dalgliesh, he said, "Thank you. It is extraordinary that a man who loved the language and literature of one of the world's greatest civilizations should be reduced to this tawdry self-justification. I have been told that murderers are invariably arrogant, but this is arrogance on the scale of Milton's Satan. Evil, be thou my good." I wonder when he last read Paradise Lost. Archdeacon Crampton was right in one criticism of me. I should have taken more trouble in choosing the people I invited to work here. You're staying the night, I believe.
Yes, Father.
That will be pleasant for us all. I hope you will be comfortable. Father Sebastian didn't accompany Dalgliesh to his old apartment in Jerome, but summoned Mrs. Pilbeam and handed over the key. Mrs. Pilbeam was unusually talkative, checking carefully in Jerome that Dalgliesh had all that was necessary. She seemed almost reluctant to depart. "Father Sebastian will have told you about the changes. I can't say Ridge and I much like the idea of alternative medicine. Still, the people who came round seemed harmless enough. They wanted us to stay on in our present jobs, and Eric Surtees too. I think he's happy enough, but Reg and I are too old for change. We've been with the fathers a good many years now, and we don't fancy getting used to strangers. Mr. Raphael says we're free to sell the cottage, so we may do that and put a bit by for our old age. Father Martin probably told you that we're thinking of moving to Norwich with him. He's found a very nice house, with a good study for himself and plenty of room for the three of us." "Well, you can't really see Father Martin looking after himself, can you? Not at over 80. And it'll be nice for him to see a bit of life. For us, too. Have you got everything you want now, Mr. Dalgliesh?" "Father Martin will be pleased to see you. You'll find him on the beach. Mr. Raphael's back for the weekend, and Miss Lavenham is here, too." Dalgliesh moved his Jaguar to the back of the cottage and set out to walk to the mere. In the distance, he saw that the pigs at St. John's Cottage were now roaming freely on the headland. They seemed, too, to have increased in number. Even the pigs, apparently, seemed to know that things were different now. As he watched, Eric Surtees came out of his cottage, bucket in hand. Dalgliesh walked along the cliff path to the mere. From the top of the steps, he could see at last the whole stretch of the beach. The three figures seemed almost willfully to have distanced themselves. To the north he could see Emma sitting high among the pebbles, her head bent over a book. On one of the nearer groins, Raphael was sitting, dangling his legs in the water and looking out to sea. Close to him, on a sandy patch, Father Martin seemed to be constructing a fire. Hearing the scrunch of Dalgliesh's shoes on the shingle, he levered himself up with difficulty and smiled his transforming smile.
"Adam, I'm glad you could come. You've seen Father Sebastian?"
"Yes, and congratulated him on the chair." Father Martin said,
"It's the one he's always wanted. And he knew it would become vacant in the autumn, but of course he wouldn't have considered accepting the offer if St. Anselm's had remained open."
He crouched again to his task.
Dalgleesh saw that he had scooped a shallow hollow in the sand and was now building a small wall of stones round it. Beside it there was a canvas bag and a box of matches. Dalgleesh sat down, leaning back on his arms and thrusting his feet into the sand. Without ceasing his work, Father Martin said, "Are you happy, Adam?"
"I have health, the job I enjoy, enough food, comfort, occasional luxuries if I feel the need of them. My poetry. Given the state of 3/4 of the world's poor, wouldn't you say that unhappiness would be a perverse indulgence? I might even say that it would be a sin. Something to be striven against, anyway. If we can't praise God as he deserves, we can at least thank him. But are those things enough? Is this going to be a sermon, Father?"
"Not even an homily. I'd like to see you marry, Adam, or at least sharing your life with someone. I know that your wife died in childbirth. That must be a continuing shadow, but we can't set aside love, nor should we wish to. Forgive me if I'm being insensitive and impertinent, but grief can be an indulgence."
"Oh, it isn't grief, Father, that's kept me single. Nothing is simple, natural, and admirable. It's egotism, love of my privacy, reluctance to be hurt or to be responsible again for another's happiness. And don't say that pain would be good for my verse. I know that. I see enough of it in my job." He paused, then said, "You're a bad matchmaker. She wouldn't have me, you know. Too old, too private, far too uncommitted, perhaps with hands too bloodstained." Father Martin selected a smooth, round stone and placed it with precision. He looked as happily occupied as a small child. Dalgleesh added, "And there's probably someone at Cambridge."
"Oh, with such a woman, there probably is. At Cambridge or elsewhere. That means you will have to take trouble and risk failure. That, at least, would be a change for you. Well, good luck, Adam."
The words sounded like a dismissal. Dalgleesh got to his feet and looked towards Emma. Then he saw that she, too, had got to her feet and was walking towards the sea. They were only 50 yards apart. He thought, "I'll wait, and if she comes to me, that at least will mean something, even if it's only to say goodbye." And then the thought struck him as cowardly and ungallant. He had to make the first move. He moved to the edge of the sea. The small sheet of paper with the 6 lines of verse was still in his wallet. He took it out, and, tearing it into small pieces, dropped them into the next advancing wave and watched them slowly disappear in the creeping line of foam. He turned again towards Emma, but when he began moving, he saw that she too had turned and was already walking towards him on the strip of dry sand between the bank of pebbles and the receding tide. She drew close, and without speaking, they stood shoulder to shoulder, looking out over the sea. When she spoke, her words surprised him.
"Who is Sadie?"
"Why do you ask?"
"When you were coming round, you seemed to expect that she was waiting for you."
"God," he thought, "I must have looked a mess. Dragged half naked up the shingle, bleeding, covered with sand, spewing water and blood, spluttering and retching." He said, "Sadie was very sweet. She taught me that, although poetry was a passion, it needn't be the whole of life. Sadie was very wise for 15 and a half. He thought he heard a low, satisfied laugh, but it was caught in a sudden breeze. It was ridiculous at his age to feel this uncertainty. He was torn between resentment at the adolescent indignity of it and a perverse pleasure that he was capable of so violent an emotion. And now the words had to be said. Even as they fell dully upon the breeze, he judged them in all their banality, their inadequacy. He said, "I would very much like to see you again, if the idea doesn't repel you. I thought, I hoped, that we might get to know each other."
He told himself, I must sound like a dentist making the next appointment. And then he turned to look at her, and what he saw in her face made him want to shout aloud. She said gravely, There's a very good train service between London and Cambridge now, in both directions. And she held out her hand. Father Martin had finished preparing his fireplace. Now he took from the canvas bag a sheet of newspaper and bunched it into the hollow. Then he laid the Anselm papyrus above it, and, crouching, struck a match. The paper caught fire immediately, and it seemed that the flames leapt at the papyrus as if it were prey. The heat for a moment was intense, and he stepped back. He saw that Raphael had come beside him and was silently watching. Then he said, What are you burning, Father? Some writing which has already tempted someone to sin and may tempt others. It's time for it to go. There was a silence. Then Raphael said, I shan't make a bad priest, Father. Father Martin, the least demonstrative of men, laid a hand briefly on his shoulder and said, No, my son. I think you may make a good one. Then they watched together in silence as the fire died down and the last frail wisp of white smoke drifted over the sea. This is Charles Keating. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Death in Holy Orders by P.D. James. This program was produced and directed by Robert Kessler. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2001 by P.D. James. Production copyright 2001, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved. Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.